Full Story is supported by Australian Industry Group, Australia's largest and most experienced industry association. From workplace laws to skills shortages and compliance, Australian businesses face challenges every day. Supporting over 60,000 businesses nationwide, Australian Industry Group is Australia's trusted business partner for compliance, advocacy and growth. Members enjoy the benefits of instant HR and legal advice, along with access to a team of experts in workplace relations, compliance, legal, skills development, apprenticeships, and more. Whether you're shaping strategy, managing people, or driving operations, Australian Industry Group exists to help businesses of all sizes thrive. Learn more and join today at australianindustrygroup.com.au.
This is The Guardian.
Hi, Regid Ahmed here, coming to you from Gadigal land. 3 million files, 2,000 videos, and 180,000 images, all relating to disgraced financier and sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and his communications with high-profile personalities around the globe. But the latest trove of documents released as part of the US Department of Justice investigation into Epstein are said to be barely scratching the surface. Today, we're bringing you an episode from The Guardian's international news podcast, Today in Focus, where we hear from survivor Lisa Phillips, who suffered years of abuse by Epstein. And we also hear from Guardian columnist Moira Donegan on the millions of files that have still not been released. Here's host Annie Kelly.
And just a warning before we start, this episode does contain swearing and some reference to sexual assault.
Good morning. President Trump signed the Epstein Files Transparency Act.
Nearly a week ago, U.S. Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche stood up in front of a crowd of reporters
to produce all documents, files, records, videos,
and told the world that the release of another 3.5 million documents put a full stop on the investigation into the Epstein files.
I hope that the work that the men and women within this department have done over the past 2 months hopefully is able to bring closure.
But for Lisa Phillips, one of Epstein's survivors, this just didn't land well.
Oh, boy. Oh, this, everything that man says just irks me. It really does, because it's just like, it's over. We're not releasing anything. It's not over. It's not over until the survivors say it's over.
Since then, survivors like Lisa have watched as the headlines have been dominated by revelations about the rich and powerful men linked to Jeffrey Epstein.
Well, the documents also include email correspondence between tech billionaire Elon Musk and Epstein. The new email show that Musk...
After emails were discovered, which suggest that Lord Mandelson sent market-sensitive information to the convicted sex offender...
appearing
Jeffrey
to show
Epstein.
Andrew Mountbatten Windsor crouched over an unidentified woman are featured in the latest disclosure of files linked to the late American sex offender.
Yet far less attention or airtime has been paid to the other group of people in the files, the women and girls like Lisa, who Epstein trafficked and abused.
I can tell you that we still need answers, and no one's been held accountable.
And who say they have been betrayed by the U.S. justice system.
They have been very careless with these files, very careless with the survivor names. And they're redacting the names of these people, these politicians and these powerful people. Who are you protecting here?
From The Guardian, I'm Annie Kelly. Today in Focus, why the fight for justice for Epstein's victims isn't over. Moira Donegan, welcome to Today in Focus. You're a columnist for Guardian US, and you have been following this story for a long time. You've covered every new update, every release, every dead end, every twist and turn. I mean, so much has happened in this last week, hasn't it? But can you just give us a sense of the scale and the reach of the documents that were released on Friday? What was in them? What were these documents?
It's a massive amount of documentation. So these documents that were released on Friday and which have been released in previous sort of like drops of Epstein-related material span several federal and state investigations into Jeffrey Epstein, his conduct related to underage girls, and his death in prison in 2019. They also relate to a bunch of just his personal communication. One of the most sort of scintillating pieces or genres of documents have been released has been his personal emails, in which he seems to have very extensive connections to American elites across a range of fields. You know, I think a big part of this story is just the sheer scale of the documentation that's being released. You know, the Justice Department uploads these documents to its website in massive tranches, and they're not labeled or indexed in any way. And so you have to sort of reverse engineer what you're looking at and where it came from.
And Moira, we're speaking to you on Tuesday afternoon. There have already been so many revelations since Friday. Should we be bracing ourselves for more in the days to come?
You know, there's a lot of sort of speculation surrounding what's incriminating and what's not. And I would urge a little bit of caution, but I also think what's going to happen is that some of the most interesting context and the most interesting revelations that are going to be discovered in these documents are things that still have yet to be found. You know, this is a massive amount of material. Some of it is very banal. There's not a very easy, quick way to separate out what's relevant, what indicates new or reveals new truth about Epstein's role during his life or his relationship with the elites or his conduct with underage children. So there's a lot to get through. I think we're going to discover quite a bit more.
All right, so just a massive job. I mean, obviously, we've got to say at this point that simply being in the Epstein files doesn't prove any wrongdoing. I think what has been clear when even the bits and pieces that I've been looking at over the last couple of days is that one of the most disturbing things really is the tone in which some of these men are discussing the young women who are also in these files and the tone of the emails between them. And I wondered if that was something that struck you too.
Yes. So Richard Branson, the billionaire, refers in some of these emails to Epstein's harem. A few months ago, there was a release of a sort of like book of notes and reminiscences that was compiled for Epstein for his 50th birthday that included many references to young women, many vulgar sexual references, one drawing of Epstein sort of presenting a balloon to some little girls, and then, you know, later being sexually serviced by naked women with the implication that they're the same people. You know, as you mentioned, Annie, there's very little evidence necessarily to suggest that, you know, merely being in contact with Epstein made one a party to or complicit in these abuse of children. But I don't think anybody can look at these kinds of documents and the way that women are being discussed in Epstein's private communications and not wonder how much people knew.
Yeah, it's interesting also this week that a lot of talk has been about the powerful men who are in these files. Lots of talk about Mandelson, about the Clintons. But it can seem that the women who are really at the heart of this story are in some way not being talked about, are kind of almost being overlooked. And it seems that Todd Blanche and the rest of the Justice Department kind of hope that this last load of files that were disclosed on Friday will kind of put an end to the discussion and speculation about Epstein and about who might be connected to him and what kind of activities they may have all got up together. But that didn't really happen, did it?
Yeah, you know, I think there's one way of looking at this story. It's a very popular way of looking at this story that is about the bad behavior and embarrassment of powerful men, right? But there's a lot of people in this story who are implicated in the story who are not rich and famous, who are not particularly powerful. And that's these girls, now women, who were victimized by Epstein when they were very vulnerable and very young. You know, the Justice Department has justified its own delays in the release of these documents, saying that they needed to, among other things, redact name and images of potentially victimized people. But this latest release included the unredacted names, and sometimes hundreds of times, of alleged victims. The New York Times is reporting that some of the included unredacted material includes what seems to be sexually explicit material, including possibly child sexual abuse material. And these people who were victimized by Jeffrey Epstein at a moment when he had a lot of money and they often had very little of anything, are being re-victimized by the process, and their dignity is being insulted by the notion that this is a story about the embarrassment of the powerful and not about the violence done to the less powerful. I think we owe it as journalists and as consumers of the news to treat these women with a little more respect than they were treated either by Epstein and his circle or now by the Justice Department.
My name is Lisa Phillips, and I'm a survivor of Jeffrey Epstein. I was a young model in the early 2000s, and my story starts there.
Lisa, thank you so much for joining us. We really, really appreciate your time today. So first off, could you take us back? Could you tell us about the first time that you met Jeffrey Epstein?
I was a fashion model living in New York City. I was kind of living the dream. And so in early 2000, I booked a really cool job. It was like a cover of a magazine, a 5-page spread, with another model from my agency. She was a tall, beautiful Polish girl. We booked this really cool job, flew down to Tortola in the British West Indies. And when we had our day off, this other young girl said to me, "Hey, you know, my friend owns an island nearby. And, you know, he's really great. He's a mentor of mine. He helped me to get my visa to work in the U.S. So, you know, kind of want to go see him since we're right here." And so I just agreed with her and I said, "Sure, let's go." This person sent a boat. And we got on the boat and we went across the Caribbean Sea. It was a beautiful day. I arrived on the island and spent a few hours just hanging out and went into the pool. And I met a couple other young girls there. They were younger than us. We were in our early 20s. And there was an older man in the pool with one of the girls, kind of like canoodling and kissing and things. And I was like, "Oh, that's weird," because, you know, it's always weird when you see super young girls with old men. So, but I just noted that. And then we got washed up and went to dinner, and we all sat at this long table and had delicious food. And that was the time when I met Jeffrey Epstein.
And what were your first impressions of him?
He walked in, this kind of like charming person, sat down next to me and was all giddy. And I could tell he knew the other girls really well, and I felt really comfortable. And so he kind of asked me about my aspirations and my goals, and that I felt kind of comfortable and like he was kind of like a father figure. And, you know, he asked me a lot of questions about myself. And I had told him that I grew up the first few years of my life in Oxford, England. He was like, "Oh," he kind of perked up about that. "Oh, wow." So, you know, he was like, "Do you want to meet a prince?" And so I was like, "Okay."
So what happened after dinner that night?
So we went, you know, like we were going to sleep, got in our pajamas, whatever, hanging out in the bed together, just the girls talking and stuff. And another young girl came to the door and, said Jeffrey was ready for his massage. And I'll always remember those words, "Jeffrey's ready for his massage," because at that time, you know, I look like a woman now, but I was, you know, 5'8" tall. Like I look like a little boy, you know, and so, everybody knows that Jeffrey had a certain type of girls that were always around, and they were very young, fair, blonde type of girls. And, you know, I'm this mixed race girl and looked kind of different. I mean, I had these little hands. I'm like, "I'm not massaging that grown man." It was just like a fight back and forth. Like, "I'm not massaging him." And she was like, "Well, you kind of, if he says we have to just go give him a massage, you know?" And he did spend quite a bit of time teaching us how to do a proper massage. And then it just like kind of turned dark. And then that's when, you know, Jeffrey did what he does and took out like, you know, tools and things like that and started using them on her and I and wanting to do these things with us together. And it just became really dark and really weird. And we both looked at each other not knowing what to do. And we kind of just froze in the situation. It wasn't like a run out of the room kind of thing, or I just didn't really know what to do, and I just froze. So there was a sexual assault on both of us that evening. And then, you know, as soon as it was done, we just ran out of there, ran back to the room, and just waited until the boat came in the morning, and then we just left the island as quick as we could. So that was my experience on the island.
I'm so sorry. That's horrible. Really, really horrible. After this, you went back to New York and you continued your modeling career. How did your connection with Epstein continue?
Everything changed once I got back. I do know that I had a completely different personality after the abuse. Because I just kind of had that feeling of shame and worthlessness that came over me. I didn't feel as a, you know, beautiful, strong, confident woman anymore. I kind of had a little bit of a mask on because I had a little secret that, didn't make me feel good and I couldn't talk to anybody about it. I know for sure they probably would have blamed me and said, you know, what did you do? Were you flirting? Or, you know, I just felt like people would say that. So I just, went to a couple of those groups for like rape survivors, but that was like humiliating to even talk about it because I didn't even really know how to explain it, how I ended up on an island, you know? You got to remember back then, nobody knew about Jeffrey Epstein. He wasn't a playboy. You know, he's very mysterious. And so everyone in New York kind of talked about him in kind of a good light. So, you know, think of it like a celebrity. Most people don't speak out with celebrities and stuff because nobody's going to believe you. So I just kept the pain and the shame inside and started hanging out a little bit. So kind of being a little bit of a socialite. And then also I was getting harassed by the secretaries that worked in Epstein's office, the ones that have immunity right now under the sweetheart deal they got in 2006. They've never had any criminal activity, but these women were relentless in calling the young girls, called me every single week, telling me how amazing I was and how much Jeffrey wanted to meet me and see me again and how he wanted to help me out and all these things. They tried everything. And I just kept saying, no, 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 not going back to see that creepy old man. No. And then just one day, like in the spring, maybe 4 months later, Jeffrey called me. He has a very distinct way of talking, so I knew who it was immediately. You know, it's a really fast way of talking and right to the point. Voice where you just like freeze. You know, he wasn't going to let me get away because I had seen somebody pretty important on the island. I know that now. I wasn't thinking that then. But he called me up and he said, you know, Lisa, I remember what you said on the island and that your ultimate goal was to become a Ford model. So I just went in and met the agents. And within a short period of time, I became a Ford model.
So it sounds like he knew exactly what he needed to do to keep you in his orbit. And I guess all of this power and wealth he had could also help you fulfill your ambitions.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, that's how any master predator works. You have to have a leverage over somebody. If I was just a couch potato at home eating, you know, eating potato chips, watching TV, what leverage are you going to have over me? Ambition is what most of them prey on. Right? I didn't know that at the time. I just thought, oh, I have a goal. He says you can do this goal for me. And you also abuse me. Like, fuck you. Like, you abuse me, so you owe me. I was just trapped in something that I didn't really know how to get out of with the man. And I could tell he was a powerful person. He knew powerful people who were also saying, oh, he's so amazing. And you have to remember all the young girls said, he is so amazing too, because the young girls at the time didn't talk about the abuse. Nobody talked about it. They just said, he's amazing. Trust me, I became one of those girls that said, he's amazing later on because I didn't talk about the abuse either.
I mean, in my own like reporting career, I spent about 5 or 6 years reporting on human trafficking and modern slavery. And I did like dozens and dozens and dozens of interviews with sex trafficking survivors in all different types of situations and contexts. And it didn't matter if you were somebody who was, you know, dependent on drugs and needed, you know, somebody to just literally put a roof over your head. And the connection between all of them was this idea of coercion, not being physical force, but this very complex emotional bond that comes with a power imbalance. It exerts a tremendous psychological hold over you, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's a major trauma bond. There has to be that good with the evil. You know, there has to be something they're dangling over you. And I like that you said that. It's all walks of life. I mean, I came from a really great family. I moved from an 8-bedroom chateau in Brussels, in Belgium. And, you know, and a lot of the Florida girls, they came from hard, you know, backgrounds, you know, came from drug addict moms, dads in jail. They went after these young girls that didn't come from a good life. and really mm-hmm. abused these underage girls and held that over their head because they needed money. You know, and a lot of them will say they have this love-hate relationship with Jeffrey too. Everyone kind of did because he was a charming, nice man most of the time. And he knew everybody and he was behind the scenes. It was a kind of secret society. He was not a Donald Trump that was out there gregarious and wanting all the girls around him and having the pageants and all the things. He was the opposite. So that's why people trusted him and he was quiet about things and he got into your head.
So you eventually get away from Epstein once you start realizing what he's doing to you and all the other girls.
The last time I spoke to Jeffrey, I said, I kind of know what's going on here. And then just left New York City and went to LA. And that's when all the stuff started coming out about Epstein. After those years and after I didn't speak to Epstein anymore, I went on, got married, had kids and went on with my life. And, knew some things that were happening, but I didn't really pay attention to it. I wanted nothing to do with any of this. So I didn't pay attention to it for about 15 years. And then he died. And I remember when he died, I had this moment of all these emotions came back. Because now when your abuser dies, it's now all of a sudden you're free. And people are speaking out, so you're paying attention. And their stories, every single one of the stories are exactly the same story that I had. But it was Virginia Giuffre who spoke out that I saw. I remember that she was getting vilified for speaking out about Prince Andrew. He was Prince Andrew at the time. So I was like, okay, I'm going to support her. So I started reaching out to the survivor sisters and Virginia and spoke to her. We started adding up the dates and looking at the flight logs when they came out and things like that. And so I said, I want to support you.
In the year 2000, I was taken to Jeffrey Epstein's island while on a photo shoot on a nearby island. Who I saw and what I experienced there was a glimpse into a very dark and disturbing world. Epstein's reach went to the very top of fashion, arts, and entertainment. This did not just happen to underage girls in Florida. In New York City, hundreds of
And Liz, you've gone on to become one of the many women who've publicly spoken out about this. You know, you stood on Capitol Hill, you've demanded transparency and justice. I was wondering if you could just take us through the moment that you heard that finally these files were going to be released and what your initial response was, because you fought along with all these other survivors for so long for this to happen.
When we came together, we all stood there and we told our stories and we actually said, you know, if you're not going to do something about it, we're going to do it.
And also, I would like to announce here today, us Epstein survivors have been discussing creating our own list. We know the names. Many of us were abused by them. Now together as survivors, we will confidentially compile the names we all know.
We got stronger together and we started fighting together. The media started taking notice and started interviewing all of us together. And the nation started waking up and saying, wait a second, this isn't right.
If you're a survivor who wants to join us, please reach out. And to anyone who benefits from the current system, intentionally or not, remember this. Alone, yes, we are afraid. But together, we are feared. Thank you.
Every month that our nation gets stronger behind us and our nation wants to see the files, everyone's crazy about, you know, connecting the dots and wanting to know who's out there because they believe us. They know there's other men involved. They know when Todd Blanche stands up there and says, oh, there aren't other men. There's no one to prosecute. They know it's BS. So we're fighting for it because we know.
Todd Blanche, the Deputy U.S. Attorney General, said on Friday that the review of the Epstein files was over and he hoped the survivors had got the closure they needed.
Will more documents be released?
There are a small number of documents, as I said on Friday, that we're waiting for a judge to say we're allowed to release because of a protective order. But this review is over.
What was your reaction when you heard him say that?
I hope the survivors get the closure they needed because he released a few more files. It's all based in nothing factual. Other men, there weren't other men involved. I mean, you just released 2 million files that showed a lot of other men involved. And like you said, maybe there isn't anything there to prosecute, but there is more to be delivered and to be found out what was really going on.
What is it that you would ultimately want? Like, what does accountability on this mean to you? What would it look like to you?
We really don't know what that is because we're getting toyed with. The files are coming out. They're not coming out. We're going to release some things. They don't release anything. They leave a bunch of survivor names on there with the emails and IDs and all their information, even though they testified as a Jane Doe. You think they're doing that on accident? It's calculated. They're trying to scare you. They're trying to scare the survivors. They're trying to get us to back down by saying, you know what? We have power back too. Here's your name. We're putting it all out there and upsetting us all over again. They're picking a pretty big fight because, you know, we have, all of us have attorneys and all of us are concerned of what's going on. Many survivors are going to be there at the hearing coming up next week. I don't know what accountability looks like. We just want to expose all the bad guys at this point. Just expose them and embarrass them, get all the information out there.
Coming up, will we ever get to see the missing Epstein files?
Are they in compliance, I ask you, as the co-author of the law?
No, they're not. I mean, look, their release was significant and exposes the callowness, immaturity, and disgusting behavior of America's elite. But imagine what they're still holding. And there are a number of avenues for us to get that. Thomas Massie and I are going to be meeting with Blanche and Justice.
So, Moira, last week, the Department of Justice released 3.5 million new documents. But there are millions more that still haven't been made public. How likely do you think that we will see them released?
You know, the Trump administration opposed the release of these files towards the end of last year and went to some lengths to try and persuade Republican members of Congress to vote against their release. We know that Donald Trump is interested in trying to make this story go away. I think that the Justice Department is, you know, not even complying particularly robustly with the terms of the Epstein Transparency Act that have mandated the release of these files. They're going slowly. They're being partial. It seems to be a quite chaotic and haphazard release of what they do have. And I think what you have is a combination of sort of a lack of political will within the Trump administration to release these documents, combined with kind of a lack of department capacity to review them and to redact them accurately, fully, and responsibly, right? Mm. So I think that the Trump administration has some bad political instincts and some very bad options with regard to this story. I expect that there will continue to be a slow drip of revelations as more of these documents become public, are searched by journalists and verified for the stories they tell us about Epstein and his circle. And I expect that this will remain a political live wire for some time to come.
And I mean, this is a difficult question because justice means different things to different people, but you've been reporting on this story a long time. How optimistic are you that the survivors will get the justice that they seek in this case?
You know, I think when we talk about justice for sexual violence survivors, we really have to keep in mind that the initial wrong of sexual abuse is often compounded after people come forward, right? By mockery and humiliation, by disregard, by a sort of treatment of their story, not as a morally serious event into itself, but kind of as entertainment, right? So when we think about justice, you know, I think we need to think about justice not just for sexual violence, but also for the mistreatment of those who expose it. Jeffrey Epstein is dead. He cannot be tried for his sexual abuse of girls again. You know, that opportunity ended when he died in jail in 2019. But I think one source of justice, one source of potential healing, is in having the truth be out there and in having the mandate for secrecy be lifted from the survivors and the responsibility of shame being placed back onto the perpetrators.
Lisa, talking to you, I can like really hear like and feel your disappointment and your frustration and your anger in the wake of this latest release of documents and the way it's been framed by the administration. But, you know, this isn't the first time this has happened. As you've talked about, this is a huge ongoing battle. So I wondered, in the light of all that, if you could tell us, what is it that keeps you going? What keeps you moving forward with this?
I think what keeps all of us survivors moving forward is the fact that we want to protect children and future children. So if there is a sex trafficking ring that all of us survivors believe there is, it didn't just end when Epstein died. And there's many, many sex trafficking rings that are going on all throughout the United States. The survivors are mostly moms that have kids the same age as we were when we were abused. So you see the innocence in a little kid. And we thought maybe at 16 or 20 that we were so mature and we could handle everything. We couldn't. And when we look at our kids, a 15-year-old, 20-year-old, they're still all kids. So I think the fight, yes, of course we want accountability and justice, but the fight is really to stop them.
Lisa, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Andy.
And that's it for today. My thanks to Lisa Phillips and Moira Donegan. And you can read all of Moira's reporting on the Epstein files at theguardian.com. Today's episode was produced by Tom Glasser and Yasin El-Medin and presented by me, Annie Kelly. The sound design was Brian McNamara and the executive producer was Maz Ebtaj. We'll be back this afternoon with the latest.
This is The Guardian.